This is Packer and Durham on ACCN and SiriusXM Channel 371.
Pete Sampson, The Athletic, will be here bottom of the hour. We'll get to more on Notre Dame and their status. And he wrote a great piece about their independence over the weekend. I highly recommend it. But first, Roddy, we start this hour with a friend for years and a friend for tears. Heather Denich is here from ESPN.com, covers the college football playoff. Oh, Heather and I used to sit at the press room at Cole Fieldhouse before Maryland-Georgia Tech basketball games and speak of the ways of the world. That was long before we ever got to college football playoff and evictions from leagues. And okay, Heather, I want to go to the wheelhouse first here. It seemed like last week in Charlotte we were hearing more positive conversation about eight teams in the playoff than 12. Did you get that same sense?
So, yes, from where you were, but not necessarily from the national perspective. I mean, this is the summer of feasibility, right? Where every conference is going back to their membership, presidents, athletic directors, coaches, players. What do you guys think about this? And this is exactly why, because as shocking as it might sound to some, not everybody loves the idea of a 12-team playoff. I'm curious as to how this information that has come out about Oklahoma and Texas further changes that perspective for some people, if it does at all. You know, I spoke with CFP Executive Director Bill Hancock very briefly yesterday, who told me, from his perspective, nothing has changed. This is still on track for them to continue to seek feedback from their membership and then meet in late September with the 11 presidents and chancellors who control the playoff.
Heather, you know the CFP as well as anything. Do you think if let's say the rest of college football banded together because of this Oklahoma and Texas news and said, nope, we're not going to 12, let's go to 8, do you think Oklahoma and Texas still make the jump to the SEC, or does that put a wrench in it for everybody?
Well, you know, that's a good question. And I think the timing of everything we'll know a lot more about, if not today, later this week. Look, if everybody else isn't in favor of it, you have to remember it comes down to those 11 presidents and chancellors in late September who give this the green light or not. And we don't know when they would say this is going to happen, right? Can it happen before the end of the 12-year contract? Yes, it can, but there's still a lot of moving parts to answer that. So I don't think it would impact Oklahoma and Texas moving to the SEC. That's just a gut reaction, because I think that that ship is sailing quickly towards that direction.
It's a good point. I think that part of it is going to – that transaction is going to take place. The runoff from that transaction, we can all speculate about. The CFP proposal, though, and I'm glad you brought this up, it may have been one thing in Charlotte, another thing in Hoover, something else in Arlington could be very different in Indianapolis, and who knows what it is when the Pac-12 starts talking about it, because they haven't been in it in the last few years. But that idea of this expansion plan is more of a welcoming to everybody, as you said the last time you were with Mark and I. How does yesterday impact the landscape of college football as it relates to the playoff in your mind, Heather, from where you see it?
Well, when you try to envision what it's going to look like, first of all, it's difficult. And when you talk about conference champions, which is what the part of this 12-team proposal is based on, what exactly does that look like? Who are these conferences? You know, but even before the Oklahoma-Texas news, there was some fear that the SEC was going to get seven teams in this thing. Well, guess what? If you have a 10-2 Oklahoma and a 9-3 Texas, they're probably getting in too if they're going through an SEC schedule. So I think that that might cause some people to pump the brakes on, yeah, this is great for everybody. But when you look at the proposal itself, who are those conference champions? Who's the Big 12 champion? Is it Oklahoma State?
Right.
Maybe it's an easy road for them now, right? Or does everybody bolt? Does the Big 12 dissolve? And then you're guaranteed like an American Athletic Conference champion and a MAC champion, you know? So I think that's really hard to figure out, is who joins the 12 as far as the benefits awarded in that system to conference champions. And of course, you know, the Big 10 and the Pac-12 conference champion would be in there. But what do the conferences look like to produce that field is very interesting. Hmm.
So Heather, I have a question about that, because you mentioned the end of September being when these 11 chancellors and presidents come together. Are they going to decide, all right, top six conference champions, put it in concrete, without knowing the answer to that question, how many conferences we're going to have?
Well, that's a great question. And I think that's why maybe it gets pushed back as far as the decision. But here's the thing. I wouldn't be surprised if we have more of an answer on that by late September, because I guarantee you every commissioner in the country right now is watching this Big 12 SEC plotline like a hawk, right? And they all have people on speed dial ready to react. They have to, because once this goes down, it is self-preservation, survival of the fittest, moving pieces, right? And, you know, you would think that the dust has to settle by then, but I don't know. It's hard to speculate on that. But people I've talked to involved in the CFP say, well, you know, maybe it might delay the timeline a bit. Sure, that's possible. But we're still on track as far as everything that had been before this Oklahoma-Texas news broke.
Heather, I'm going to jump to the end of the game, as Pac likes to say. And once a show, I try and go back to one of Packer's little, you know, odes, if you will. You want to find out who's winning, you got to follow the money. Okay. So we talked, and when you were with us before, we talked about the B word in rights fees, right? We realized that is in play if this thing gets to 12. But that was with solid Power Five conference structure. That was with automatic conference champions. That was with a general understanding of the tag on the media rights play. Does any of this change that business side of the house now in the college football playoff? If Oklahoma, Texas go and all of a sudden the walls start cracking in the Big 12, heavens knows what's going to happen in the Pac-12, the American feels like they got a chance. Do you sense rights fees changing? And the financials changing in this?
I think the financials definitely change. You know, it's unclear, I think, at this point how, but you're right. You know, Oklahoma and Texas going to the SEC changes everything. I mean, the financials would change with the Longhorn Network, right? What happens to that? Mm-hmm. And that's a question for our TV executives, of course. But, you know, It's a hard thing to imagine that there's a Longhorn Network if they join the SEC and you don't have a Crimson Tide Network and a Bulldog Network, right? So right there, the money's different. And then how does that affect every other league? Because everybody has exit fees, right? I think leaving the American Athletic costs like $10 million. And then what happens in the ACC? Their grant of rights is through, I want to say, 2036, I think. So those teams are pretty significant.
Yep.
Yeah, pretty significantly locked in with just an exorbitant amount of money to get out of that before then. So, yes, I do think the money changes. How exactly, I'm not sure, but you can count on the SEC getting an even bigger chunk of the pie.
Well, Heather, I think a lot of people are speculating that the Pac-12 are going to be buyers. Maybe the Big 12 are going to be buyers. Maybe they turn into sellers unwillingly. But where does the ACC stand in this? Wes and I have been going back and forth. What do you see the path forward for the ACC as? Should they stand pat? Obviously, Notre Dame is a big question in that. But what should the ACC do if this does indeed go through and the sand starts shifting?
Well, that's a very difficult job right now for Jim Phillips, who is still fairly new on the job, right? But like I said, everyone is watching this. And if you are Jim Phillips, you're thinking about not what's best for the conference next year, but what's best to benefit 10 years from now, right? And if you want to try to lure Notre Dame in, which I'm sure he does, I think he made public comments about that at ACC Media Day, that they've been pretty unabashed about that. Who else do you bring in to get Notre Dame to join that adds value? I'm not so sure that West Virginia is the answer there, right? So who else is available? You know, I know he has to be thinking about that, whether or not he's actually made calls to people. I don't know. I can tell you that Notre Dame athletic director Jack Swarbrick told me that he's very happy with their current position. He likes it a lot, but is also cognizant of all the moving parts that are going on right now. And as you guys know, contractually, if Notre Dame had to join, they would join the ACC. But what would happen if they could get out of that? What would happen if the Big Ten showed interest in Notre Dame? How much does it cost to get out of that deal with the ACC? I mean, to me, guys, given everything that's happened over the past 72 hours or so, all bets are off, right? Once this thing goes down, like I said, self-preservation, right?
Heather, I'm going to go back to those media meals in the Coalfield House press room here for a moment. The early stages of ACC expansion were real. When Virginia Tech and Miami and BC came invading that league, this feels like it is. That was at a time when it was considered pretty drastic. The early 90s with Florida State to the ACC and Arkansas and South Carolina to the SEC. That just seemed to be kind of natural progression. This feels pretty stark to that. This feels like this is aggressive all over the place. Could be aggressive full-scale coast-to-coast by the time we're done. You've covered this a long time. Do you feel the same kind of sense about it?
I think aggressive is an excellent word to describe it. And, you know, I get the feeling that there's a lot of mistrust throughout college athletics right now. And I can tell you that the commissioners, and this isn't for any reason in particular, but they haven't talked weekly like they did during the pandemic, right? They were always communicating. They haven't talked as a group for a while. I don't think they have a meeting as commissioners scheduled anytime soon. I know a week from Thursday, I think there's a call of all of the commissioners at every level. So I just think that, like you said, aggressive is a great word for it. But here's the thing. Anyone who pays attention to college athletics probably, while we're surprised about Oklahoma and Texas and this news caught everyone off guard, including the Big 12, this is what happens. And I don't think it's going to be the last realignment. I think years from now, we could see more. Maybe as it gets closer to the end of the ACC's grant of rights, maybe we see Florida State and Clemson flirting with the SEC. You know, people have thrown out the idea of a 32-team NFL light. I mean, there's speculation all over the place, guys. And like I said, what we're talking about now will change in 5 years and 10 years.
Good stuff.
Heather, this sport is all about nostalgia. Is this good for college sports? Like, is this good for college football? All of this talk and all this shuffling?
Well, look, if you're a fan of TCU, you're going, wait a minute, what about us? Kansas. Basketball. Wait a minute. What about us? Right? Like, I mean, if it's not for the Army-Navy game, what happens to those schools? I mean, when you say aggressive, there's also a sense of selfishness, of this is what is best for me and not what is best for college athletics. Think about the players who have zero say in this and are wondering what the hell is going on right now and what does this mean to me? I don't know if they care. Maybe they do. But at the end of the day, there are going to be a lot of schools who fade into irrelevance, and this is going to be a greater divide of the haves and have-nots, because that's what this is. It's a business.
Yeah. Heather Dinitz, ESPN.com. Thank you as always. Take care. Enjoy the rest of your summer. Yeah, right.
You're ready.
Appreciate it as always. Look forward to more work from Heather on this topic and the CFP as we move forward. Thanks, Heather.
Thanks, guys.
All right. Don't forget, the Huddle's going to get you ready starting tomorrow night with the ACC full previews. Starts at 8 o'clock with a preview of the Atlantic. The Coastal is Thursday night, and Friday night, season predictions. All three shows right here on ACC Network, all three at 8 o'clock, and all three also available on the ESPN app. When we come back, Roddy Jones and I compare our defensive preseason ballots ahead of the 9 o'clock announcement of the ACC preseason team and the preseason player of the year on Packer and Durham.
Packer and Durham. Here's Mark Packer and Wes Durham.
Tuesday edition, Packer and Durham. Roddy Jones here. Official ACC preseason football announcement and player of the year coming up 9 o'clock right here on the show. Pete Sampson of The Athletic in about 10 minutes. Roddy and I shared our ballots on the offensive side in the first hour. Here in hour two, we're going to share the defensive ballot, including special teams for you. There are going to be a lot of similarities. There are going to be some that are different. And I think, Roddy, we started talking about competitive depth of certain teams. Well, there's real competitive depth when you start putting some of these lists together. Let's go to the defensive line, where we both selected Miles Murphy of Clemson on our ballot, and we both selected his teammate Brian Brzee. You went Amari Barno of Virginia Tech and Reva Hasek of Carolina, and I took the Georgia transfer Jermaine Johnson of Florida State. And I think the secret weapon of Pitt's defensive line this year is Kalijah Cansey, the defensive tackle. Those are the two spots where we differed.
Yeah, you got no arguments for me on Kalijah Cansey. He was a guy that kind of made you forget about the fact that Jalen Twyman didn't play last year because of how disruptive he was. Interesting, the approach that you took, Wes, going with a couple of transfers, just the second transfer so far to make the list. Charleston Rambo made your wide receiver list. Now Jermaine Johnson makes your defensive end list. I think both of those guys are going to have outstanding seasons. I think both of them are going to make major impacts. But there's a little bit of a philosophical difference putting some transfers on there, as I did not have a single transfer on my list.
I want to let you once again wax poetic on Reva Hasek, because I know this is your guy. I mean, this is a guy who gets no love when it comes to ACC D-line play a year ago. And you told me prior to I think we did the Western Carolina game, right, late in the year. You said, you go back and watch the snaps on this guy. He sets up Jeremiah Gimmel, Chaz Surratt. He set up Carolina's linebackers last year, essentially.
Yeah, he can do it all. He's got the quickness to be able to penetrate. He's got the strength to hold the point. He is one of those guys that just overwhelms offensive linemen. And even when he's not getting sacks or tackles for loss, when teams are trying to double team him, you just can't do it because he's so strong. So he is a guy. I am going to stand up and wave the 51 from North Carolina flag all year. Reva Hasek, that's my guy, because I just love the way he plays ball, and he is physically overwhelming in a similar way to Brian Brzee. He's not as physically gifted as Brzee, but those clips alone show you how overwhelming he can be for offensive linemen on that defensive line. I'm a big fan of Reva Hasek.
All right, good call there. Let's go linebackers here. We had only one the same. Jeremiah Gimmel of Carolina. Oh, and Peyton Wilson. Sorry, Peyton Wilson. But you had I had Servassier Dennis of Pitt. We had two.
I like the Servassier Dennis pick, but how can you go against James Skalski? He's been there for 17 years. He's the old grizzled veteran that's going to have a million tackles. He's getting everybody lined up. This is kind of the role that James Skalski has played. I mean, how many times has he been overlooked for all ACC teams because there's more guys on that defense that are more flashy? He's as solid a player as there is in the league. He's as good a player as there is in the league on the defensive side of the football. Servassier Dennis, explosive, love the tackles for loss. I'm not taking anything away from him. He's a really good player too. But James Skalski, come on, Wes. I mean, again, that's one of those for the last 10 years, you can just write Skalski in there.
Yeah, 10 years. That's exactly right. A decade worth of James Skalski. Okay. Jeremiah Gimel is a name, but is it a name? Is it at the front of your mind? Is it a, you know, guy had a comment about we don't want the 12-team playoff. Seems he built some momentum there. He did a great job with the media last week at the kickoff. But, Roddy, was Jeremiah Gimel a guy who was on people's list in April or May last year because of who Carolina was with some of these other guys? And now we're looking at Jeremiah Gimel. You start looking at production, he's a huge piece. So if they're going to be better on defense, he'll have a lot to say about it, I think.
Yeah, he's a massive piece, and he does a lot for that defense. And to be honest with you, he, in a lot of ways, is who allowed Chaz Surratt to be Chaz Surratt, to be the penetrator, the disruptor that he was. So yeah, you know, in talking to Surratt and in talking to Jay Bateman, the defensive coordinator at UNC, they rave about Jeremiah Gimel's knowledge, Jeremiah Gimel's overall leadership ability on that defense, and his relationship with Surratt and his relationship now with Eugene Asante, who's going to be standing next to him, is going to be really important. As a side, I would not be surprised if Eugene Asante is on this list by the end of the year. But Jeremiah Gimel certainly deserves it. And I don't know. I don't know if he was a big enough name before his comments, but I think so. He's always been on my radar.
Well, the other guy that is going to be on the list, and he'll be at the top of the scouting report for opposing offenses, is Peyton Wilson of NC State. It is quite simply a guy who has got an incredible mindset, an incredible physical set athletically, Roddy. He's going to be potentially one of the best playmakers in the ACC, if not the college game this fall.
Yeah, he's got to be on the short list for favorites for Defensive Player of the Year in the conference. A sideline-to-sideline linebacker, a guy that can come off the edge and get you some sacks, some tackles for loss. He's a heart and soul type player, a guy that just plays hard, loves the game of football, and has the physical abilities to be able to go out and execute. He's as exciting as there is at linebacker in the entire conference. And again, going to be on that short list for Defensive Player of the Year going into the season.
All right, let's go to the secondary, because there's an interesting development kind of in the ACC here in the secondary. This is a part of the league that there's really been a hard time developing clarity. You see, Roddy and I both have Andrew Booth at one of the corners. We differ on Tony Grimes and Jermaine Waller. We both had Bubba Bolden. I went Joey Blunt. Roddy went Nolan Turner. But Andrew Booth Jr. is the easy pick for me, Roddy, because the guy is a playmaker. And people say, okay, well, he's got all the highlights. Yes, he does, but he has all the highlights for a reason. He's in position to make the plays. I don't know if there's a better corner in the league, Roddy.
Yeah, and the NFL draftniks would agree with you there, at least in terms of the early predictions going into the season. He's one of those guys that's got all the bona fides. Five-star recruit, was the second cornerback in the country behind Derek Stingley coming out of college, and I think we've all heard of him. He is a ball hawk, and when he gets his hands on the football, it sticks, whether it's with one hand or two. Like, the guy just makes plays. Is there some room to grow with consistency? Sure. That's the case for a lot of young players. But in terms of ball skills, length, athleticism, you're not going to find anybody any better, which is why Andrew Booth is on that list. And I want to make a point. I like your pick of Tony Grimes. Young player, has a lot of Andrew Booth-like abilities and Andrew Booth-like measurables. But Jermaine Waller from Virginia Tech was hurt for a lot of last year, which is part of the reason Virginia Tech struggled in the secondary. But Jermaine Waller was one of the best corners in the conference 2 years ago. They had Caleb Farley on one side, Waller on the other, and they were absolutely fantastic. The fact that Jermaine Waller missed most of last season, I think we've kind of forgotten a little bit. Maybe some haven't, but Jermaine Waller is an excellent cornerback. He may end up being the best corner by the end of the season. He's that good. I mean, I really like his game at a time when everybody was throwing away from Caleb Farley. Jermaine Waller had to compete on a play-in, play-out basis, and he stood up to the task.
And we talked about this late in the year a season ago. Tony Grimes' skill set was on full display toward the back end of the season. A lot of people wondered, you know, how was he being integrated? How was he going to be orientated into what Carolina was doing scheme-wise? Remember, he was supposed to be a senior in high school a season ago, showed up early in August, got a chance to get on the field. Grimes made plays later in the year. That expectation level of what he did against people like Texas A&M and others, though, is part of the reason he's making some list, I think, in the preseason. For sure, it's one of the reasons he made mine. Real quick on safety. Falling into the Skalski category is Nolan Turner, who's back for his decade of football at Clemson. I think have Joey Blunt been healthy all year long for Virginia, I think he would have been an all-ACC safety. I think he does a tremendous job. Another one of those Virginia safeties that sets everybody up. And last year, Virginia needed a setup guy to get Nick Jackson, Zane Zandier, all those guys some run. When he was off the field, Roddy, it affected the Cavaliers, I thought.
Yeah, I agree with you. And safety was pretty hard for me to go through because you have a short list of guys, and a lot of them were hurt. You look at Joey Blunt, who missed a lot of time last year, and Nasir Greer, who missed a lot of time last year. You can kind of go up and down. And if once you get away from Bubba Bolden, there's a couple of different guys that all have things that you can poke holes in. But Nolan Turner is about as solid as it gets. Dabo Swinney absolutely loves him. Yeah. So I went there. I do not disagree with your Joey Blunt pick. He is an excellent player as well, a tackling machine in that secondary.
All right. Let's go to the kick punter and special teams player. Roddy put Nick Skiba on there twice. I put Skiba as the kicker, Lou Headley as the punter, and I made Jameel Gibbs the special teams player for his return game stuff, Roddy.
Yeah, I went with Skiba as the special teams player, one, because, I mean, what is that? Is that a returner? Is that a kicker? I don't know why that's on the list. I've had a little bit of a gripe about the ambiguity of that position for a while. But the fact that we kick the ball out of the end zone so much, like the guy who ends up being that returns like one kick for a touchdown and 10 kicks overall the entire season. So I went with the kicker. Nick Skiba's automatic. So let's go ahead and stick him in there.
All right. All that worked cleanly. Ambiguity of the special teams player. Roddy wants it out.
Hey, what is that? So is it the returner? Is he a kicker? Is he a punter? Is it just
Let me ask you this before we go to break. Pete Sampson, The Athletic, is next. You also probably don't want four defensive linemen, three linebackers, and four in the secondary either. You probably want a 3-3-5, don't you? That's right.
I agree with four defensive linemen. Nobody plays with three linebackers on. Like, who plays it? We need two defensive tackles or like a one defensive tackle, defensive end / defensive tackle. You can go either way. And then you need that sort of stand-up hybrid linebacker. You need two linebackers and then like a linebacker nickel spot. And then in the same, you have to have five DBs. Right, everybody plays with five DBs. Right. Like, what?
All right,
what are we doing
I don't. We got to stop this train when we come back. Pete Sampson of The Athletic joins us. Notre Dame has become a very interesting topic given Texas and Oklahoma's apparent interest in the Southeastern Conference. Pete wrote a great piece about Irish independence over the weekend. We'll talk with him about that and more, and the relationship of new Commissioner Jim Phillips and the Irish, next on Packer and Durham.
This is the Packer and Durham Podcast. This is the Packer and Durham Podcast.
The old kind of, you know, quip is Notre Dame loves two things. One is being Catholic. Second is independence. And sometimes those things get in reverse order. Sometimes they like independence even being more than Catholic. That's supposed to be a joke, but it didn't go over very well.
Jim Phillips last week at his commissioner's forum in the ACC, where the Notre Dame question came up pretty quick after the Irish. Well, yeah, it was funny. After the Irish spent a year as a football playing member of the Atlantic Coast Conference. And that's where our friendship with Pete Sampson, The Athletic, Roddy, really derived. Been with us several times on Packer and Durham. And Pete gets a little time and a half pay today because he's actually on vacation and is good enough to step away from that for a few minutes to join us by phone. Pete, I got to ask you, in the wide world of college athletics and all the plate tectonics going on here, how does Notre Dame react to Oklahoma and Texas, or do they even care at this point?
I think they care, but I think the reaction is we really like our position. I think the deal with the ACC is probably – it's getting better for Notre Dame as time wears on. Maybe it's not for the ACC is, you know, you played the Jim Phillips audio and sort of the idea that Notre Dame joining could sort of tear up the broadcast contract and renegotiate and everybody could make more money. And on top of that, the 12-team playoff, whenever that comes around, I think that's better for Notre Dame's independence. The potential of taking, you know, your broadcast rights to market again for Notre Dame beyond NBC, you know, doing some things in-house, I think that makes Notre Dame more independent. So I think Notre Dame looks at, you know, what's happened with Texas and Oklahoma, and you got to be aware of it, but I don't think it really changes their position about how they feel about where they stand in the whole thing.
Pete, I think that the million-dollar question is, with all the shifting that's going on, is what would it take? Is it access to the playoff, restricted access to the playoff that it would take for Notre Dame to jump in? Is it a financial thing? I mean, you mentioned all the reasons that Notre Dame's independence is solidified, but what would it take in your estimation to make Notre Dame at least have to make the tough decision or consider joining a league?
I mean, I talked to Bubba Cunningham, North Carolina AD, and you know, he's a double domer up here, and he's probably put it as succinctly as anybody. It's three things. One, access to the national championship of football. They have that. Ability to broadcast out of your home games. They have that. That's not going away. And then a place for your Olympic sports. They have that with the ACC. So as long as those three fundamentals don't change, the financial terms of this, I don't think are going to be enough to drive Notre Dame to make a decision. So if you're the ACC, you try to force the move or you try to induce the move. If you're Jim Phillips, you try to like sort of sweeten the pot so much that Notre Dame is like, ah, we can't afford not to do this. I think that's a pretty high bar to clear. You know, the forcing of the move, where, you know, you're under contract through 2036. I think that's difficult as well. So it's hard for me to look at the ACC and be like, aha, if I was Jim Phillips, this is what I would do to sort of force Notre Dame to change its position.
Pete, the article you wrote over the weekend is a fascinating study. When Notre Dame first came into the ACC, as a basketball member, Jack Nolan told me to read the book Talking Irish by Steve Delson. And it proved to be an invaluable resource just because it gave me the historical guidelines of what ultimately carried Notre Dame in this football prowess early in its school history. I thought the other thing that you covered in this is football independence is more of a pillar of the university than just a pillar of athletics. It actually means something to the heritage and history of the institution, not just the athletic program, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, Jim Phillips is spot on. The importance of independence, I think, has sort of changed throughout the years. And Bubba Cunningham and I talked about this as well. It's just, there have been times where being independent was just a thing Notre Dame football did. And there have been times, I think we're living alone right now, where independence says much more about the university at large. It certainly go way back to the Newt Rockne days and, you know, the Big Ten and being frozen out there. That was an institutional part of being independent more so than it was football. But I think we're living in a time now where Notre Dame sort of views independence as it's not just football, it's the university itself. And that's something that I think is sort of lost in the general public when we're just talking about independence as a media rights issue. It's not. It's a cultural issue for Notre Dame. I don't think people outside sort of the sphere around Notre Dame maybe grasp that all the time.
So Pete, you referenced some of the stuff that Notre Dame is doing in-house from a media standpoint that could further guarantee or solidify its independence. David Hale had a long thread about it where he went into it. Yep. Some. Can you go into some of that more? What is Notre Dame doing in-house that could provide them with some financial security and an additional revenue stream from a media standpoint in their direct-to-consumer models? What is going on there, and where do they see the future with it being?
So they've sort of started Fighting Irish TV, which they sort of view as like a Netflix for Notre Dame athletics. Do they get to a point where they can put I think a home game against maybe a lesser school on that network and sort of drive subscriptions that way? That's a pretty long bridge to get to that. But ultimately, I think that's where they would like to go. They'd like to at least have the option of producing their sort of their own network. And I think even if you come to Notre Dame and you sort of see the studios and technology that they have for sort of their own in-house production, they put a lot of money into that. And NBC will actually use Notre Dame's production, sort of not truck, it's like an actual building in the stadium, to produce Notre Dame home games at times. So I think that's sort of, Notre Dame really likes to tell its own story. I think sometimes there's a bit of exceptionalism with that where, you know, they get a little too carried away with it. But I do think that Notre Dame always is looking for like a Notre Dame produced bespoke solution to some of its problems. And I think that that also fits into independence. If you're all in with a conference, you sort of have to do what everyone else does. And that's really sort of never been Notre Dame's MO.
Pete, here in our final minute or so, Jack Swarbrick was in that working group with Greg Sankey, Craig Thompson, for the college football playoff proposal. And I think you know where I'm going here. I'm anxiously awaiting your story with Jack Swarbrick to talk about that development and how it manifested itself, because the relationship of that group, those four guys, and now the invitation of Texas and Oklahoma, potentially the SEC, the timing on that is incredibly fascinating.
Yeah, me too. That is that's high on my list of stories. I'm thinking back from vacation to sit down with Jack Swarbrick and talk to him about, like, I mean, for how much they talked about that group, you know, they've been working on the 12-team playoff for 2 years. Nobody knew about it. Well, within sort of the secret within the secret is the Bowlesby-Sankey dynamic between the Big 12 and the SEC, right? And Swarbrick had a front row seat for that. I'm fascinated to sort of know what he knew when he knew it. And what impact does this have on the 12-team playoff? I think we're all hopeful it's going to be there in 2023 with all the decks being reshuffled. Do we sort of have to wait out the entire contract now because nobody knows what conference affiliation is going to look like 2 years from now?
Yeah, great stuff. Pete, thank you for the time. Appreciate you stepping away from vacation. Look forward to having you back down the road.
Anytime. Thanks,
Pete.
All right, Pete Sampson covers Notre Dame for The Athletic, does a tremendous job analyzing the Irish, not just what they do on the field, but certainly from a historical and business perspective in athletics as well. All right, when we come back, in case you missed it with Mackenzie Milton, Kelsey Riggs and I had a chance to sit down and talk to the Florida State quarterback last week. There was a lot of ground covered. It is worth your time to hear him talk about the comeback to college football, and it's next on ACC Network.
Packer and Durham. The Packer and Durham Podcast.
Tuesday Packer and Durham on ACC Network continues. Preseason All-ACC team and Player of the Year for the preseason coming up top of the hour. But first, in case you missed it from Mackenzie Milton, the Florida State quarterback, and his journey back to college football. Last week, he spent some time with Kelsey Riggs and myself at the desk in Charlotte at the ACC kickoff, and we asked him, a lot of new faces at Florida State, for him, what's that bonding process been like?
No, we got a group of guys that have been there a while and a group of guys that are a bunch of new faces from transfers to freshmen. So I feel like it's a perfect combination of dudes we all have a common goal, and, you know, we want to be great on the field, but, you know, we all got certain stories, like Jermaine being from Georgia, Jordan starting at Louisville, you know. So just learning what each individual is about has been pretty cool. Obviously, you got to accelerate that process when you only have a year to be here. But I'm confident, you know, after this year, I'm going to be connected to all these guys for a while. So super grateful just to even be able to suit up in the FSU uniform.
Learning those relationships with your teammates, but also your coach. You know, this is just the second year for Mike Norvell and your first year with him. So what has that relationship kind of been like, and how have you liked the way that you've seen him work with his team?
Yeah, it's been cool just, you know, getting to play against him and now getting to play for him, just being on both sides of that. And just the way he operates, the way he is day in and day out, he's super consistent in who he is. I'm just super impressed with how he runs his program, and definitely someone, you know, I want to be connected with when I get into coaching and whatnot. He's a special coach, but even better dude.
All right, Mackenzie. Your legacy in college football, even if you don't do this, your legacy in college football is cemented. I mean, you're the quarterback of one of the college football's best teams of the last decade for sure. You've got records. You've got all this stuff.
How's it going to be different this time? What do you think you learned from November of 18 to now that makes you even better?
Man, I think just capitalizing on the little things, just enjoying every moment of this, you know. It goes by fast. I've been in college football a long time now, but yeah, just those relationships you build just with each and every person. The games come and go, but those relationships and those memories, they're there forever. So that's what it's all about. I think when I look back, just the memories I have in the locker room and whatnot, it's just been a special ride. And I think being able to be on the sideline the past couple of years, yeah, I've been able to look at the game from a different point of view. Getting to learn from like Coach Randy Shannon, our D coordinator that was at UCF, who's now at Florida State, just picking his brain on what he's thinking, just being a sponge and just soaking everything in the past 2 years, I feel like it's going to equip me to even be even better on the field this year.
You're going to start this season off with Notre Dame. This is a big primetime game on September 5th. What have the conversations been like within the locker room about how big an opportunity that is and also not making it too big of a moment?
Yeah, you know, that sets the stage for the 2021 season. That's a big game, obviously. But at the same time, we got to be where our feet are. We're a week and about 2 weeks out of fall camp. So, you know, we're going to take it back a little in the weight room, get our legs back under us, and we want to be as fresh as possible and ready to go that day. But we got to take care of business in fall camp, mesh, come together, stay healthy. Like I said, have fresh legs going into that game. And, you know, that night on September 5th, Sunday night, it's going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be rocking and dope.
All right, I want to ask you about that quote, because when you were on with Mark and I back toward the front of July, you used be where your feet are.
Yeah.
And you just said it again today. Take me through that quote, because obviously it's important to you.
So Coach Shannon, he sends me Coach Randy Shannon. You know, we go back to UCF,
sure,
and
right,
now he's at Florida State. Every Monday for the past year and a half, 2 years, you know, he sends me like a little motivational thing. It's Dr. Kevin Elko.
Okay.
And that's one of his slogans, you know, be where your feet are. So that's kind of something I've just took with myself the past couple years, just on the journey I've been through.
Right.
I can't look too far ahead. I can't look behind. You know, you are where you are today, and that's all you got. So to me, just with the rehab process and all that, it's just chipping block by block and being where I'm at. And always still having that vision where I want to go, but you got to be where your feet are, and you are who you are today. So,
did you ever think you wouldn't play again?
I mean, there would be some doubts. I won't lie to you. There's some doubts at times, you know, when I was making progress and then I got an infection in my leg. I just couldn't get range of motion back in my knee for a long, long time. And, you know, I just knew, like, if I wouldn't get that range back, I wouldn't be able to play. But eventually I did. So at times I'll say doubts crept in, but I never let myself go all the way to that dark place, mm-hmm, completely. I always had faith that, you know, really answered prayer, you know, God would see me through. And, you know, I had a great medical staff at UCF, great medical staff here, and definitely wasn't all by me. Had a great team around me, and here I am. So
yeah.
No, it's great. Yeah. It's a remarkable, and Andrea Adelson, who's our colleague and works with us here at times on ACC Network, has chronicled your story. And I know you all have a special connection. You've been very open about all the things you went through. I think you obviously have a passion to do this, and people need to realize what that culmination will be when you do step back on the field. I mean, just to watch you play in the spring, McKenzie, is a remarkable accomplishment, just to have that chance. And now, here you are again, and I think people sometimes lose sight of just how much off camera, away from the field, it is to get back to this point.
Yeah, you know, I mean, everybody goes through their trials and tribulations. You know, everybody has their battles. So I don't want to make it seem like what I went through is tougher than anybody else. But, you know, like I said, from having, you know, 9+ surgeries, you know, the infection in the leg, just there's some hard days. But, you know, I had other guys going through rehab with me. So, you know, I was able to feed off other people's, you know, stories, like Alex Smith, you know, Teddy Bridgewater, Jalen Smith. Guys that have gone through the fire before and come out on the other side and been better for it. So I've seen it done before, and to me, there's no reason I couldn't do it because, you know, I feel like I've always been wired that way. When somebody tells me I can't do something, whether it's being under-recruited or anything like that, you know, it's just extra motivation for me to go out and do something. And from the time I got hurt, I was in the mindset I was going to play again, and, you know, I just always held on to that.
Roddy, look, I know not everybody's going to be a Florida State fan. Not everybody may be a fan of a school in the ACC, but how can you not be pulling for Mackenzie Milton this fall?
You have to be. The story of his injury. First off, let's go back to the fact that he was an extremely likable and great player before he got hurt. I mean, people loved him and what he meant to college football and that UCF team before his injury. And then the injury and the ability to battle back and the grace that he handled everything with. I mean, obviously his relationship with Dylan Gabriel helped that transition. But you have to be rooting for this guy to have success because of everything he's been through. And college football's better when Mackenzie Milton's in it. And Florida State's going to be better if Mackenzie Milton is really good like he was at UCF. I've gotten a chance to talk to him a couple of times. He's a special, special person.
Yeah, sure is. And, man, there'll be a ton of people pulling for him on opening night, ironically, against Notre Dame Sunday before Labor Day. All right, when we come back, 9 o'clock hour, Tom Luganbill is here at 9:30. But first, the ACC preseason football team, the All-ACC preseason football announcement is next, including Player of the Year selection. Power Hour on Packer and Durham, and this, the Atlantic Coast Conference Television Network.
Packer and Durham.